Welcome to another episode of Systematic Geekology. This is a space where we seek to create and cultivate healthy conversations between those things we geek out on and the philosophical and theological questions that often arise out of our fandoms. Like, what does it mean to be human? What makes a hero? What makes a villain? How do the stories and narratives we geek out on shape how we live in the world? We are your priest to the geeks. We aren't all ordained, but we see ourselves as mediators at the intersection of geek culture and going deeper in our faith. We don't always have to agree, but we do respect each other, and we see everyone as a beloved child of God. Everyone geeks out on something, so come geek out with us and enjoy the show.
You're listening to an Anna's Owl Ministries podcast.
Would you still be able to fight for truth when the wizarding world thinks you're a glory hound with a savior complex? We're going to answer that question today on today's episode of Systematic Geekology. We are the priests to the geeks. I'm your host, Christian Ashley, and of course, joined by the number one wizard of all time, the one, a chocolate frog, is out there in the world. If you could just claim it, you will get his card. TJ Blackwell, how you doing, TJ?
Great, thank you.
Excellent. So, my friend, as we're about to get into Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, the fifth out of the seven books in the series, like, before we can get there, like, what have you been geeking out on?
I'll say Helldivers 2.
Okay. Still going strong with that.
Yeah.
All right. For me, I finished Lupin the Third Part 1, and I'm now on Lupin the Third Part 2, which is 155 episodes. So I'm taking it like near about three a day. So we'll see how long I get through that. I've seen a couple of them before because I've seen all of Parts 4 through 6, but I've only seen smatterings of the other ones outside of finishing Part 1 for the first time recently. So looking forward to more. We didn't come here for Lupin the Third or Helldivers. You came here because you're curious about what we have to say on Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix. One of the books that continues to help change the status quo, to enrich the world as Voldemort is gaining power in the darkness. Harry is still at school, stuck trying to figure out what he's supposed to do, forced to have occlumency lessons with Snape and deal with the immense torture of having to serve under the wrath of Umbridge as the ministry starts interfering with the school. But also the fact that he gets attacked by Dementors with Dudley at the very beginning of the book. Like, man, this is a wild book. I love this one so much, but DJ, I mentioned a couple things, but like, what is your favorite moment or scene in this book / movie?
That's really hard.
That's okay. I'm going to cheat. So if you feel like cheating, do it too.
Yeah. Right after the Dementors attack Harry and Dudley, not right after, but thematically right after that, when they take him to Grimmauld Place. And they just show up to his house and like, yeah, we're leaving. I love that. I've always loved that. That's been stuck in my head for 8 years, 10 years, 14 years. I don't know, man. series is way older than I think sometimes.
Yeah.
But man, that and Sirius and Bellatrix.
Ooh.
And Fred and George messing up the Great Hall.
Okay. Yeah, that's my number one scene. But for those who haven't read the book or anything like that, shame on you, but that's okay. We're still here to explain things. This is after months of torments brought on by Umbridge to, you know, establish her rule over the school. Like, I think at this point, has Dumbledore been kicked out? I think that's what it is. Yeah, because I think she is actually in charge of the school at this point in time. Fred and George have had it. After years of playing nice for them, you know, letting scoldings from their mother and Dumbledore keep them a little bit in line, they decide, nope, all hell is breaking loose. We're going to make this giant swamp in the middle of this part of the school that Umbridge is not going to get rid of. Filch isn't going to be able to get rid of it. As a big, huge, like magical middle finger to her, they'd inaccio their brooms, fleeing from the school to just not even graduate, but start their own business because of the loan that Harry gave them a while back from winning the Triwizard Tournament. Like, it's such a great scene because not only is that fun, but it inspires rebellion among the students, but also from Peeves, the poltergeist, who respects them enough to listen to them when they say, give her hell from us, Peeves, that he plans to do so. I love what that inspires in the students. They like Lee Jordan starts putting Nifflers into a room, levitating them so they mess and steal her stuff. You continue the other students in the DA, just Dumbledore's army continuing to practice in secret. It's a lot of fun. Like, without that scene, I think we're the lesser for what happens in this. Let's see what else. I didn't have some more. It's a smaller scene, but when Dumbledore is being confronted in the office by Fudge and Umbridge and everyone else, Harry is the only person to notice that Kingsley Shacklebolt is able to use a memory charm on Marietta, who is going to reveal their secrets to them. And the fact that he's able to do that without anyone noticing except for one person, and Harry is able to figure out what happens in like 5 seconds. I love that so much. And that scene as well is that whole point of Dumbledore very calmly talking to Fudge and everyone there. It is like Fudge, Umbridge, and two or three Aurors, I think, yeah, including Kingsley. It's like, yeah, you can try and fight me. A key word in that sentence being try.
Yeah, it's good.
Makes them look like fools. And even like maintaining the secrecy, because Fudge doesn't know that Kingsley is working for the Order of the Phoenix. So he still has to stun him and get him out of the fight, too. That's such a great play. Like, I love that scene a lot. And there was one more I was going to say. What was that? Oh, it's another smaller scene in the book where they're taking their owls for their final, well, their fifth year exams. And they're doing a defense against the dark arts. And Umbridge has been leading this class the whole time, teaching them nothing because that's what the ministry wants. And Harry has been training off screen, training with the rest of the DA. And the organizer of this part of it, who's, you know, taking the grades for everything, goes to Harry and says, hey, I heard you can produce a Patronus. Could you do that for me and get some extra bonus points? And he does it. Thinks of Umbridge being sacked as headmaster, presents a Patronus right in front of her face, which, as we learn later on, she's the one who sent the Dementors after him. So it makes it even doubly better as like another huge magical middle finger to her. Like, this book is so great. It's one of my favorites in the series. So is there anything else you wanted to add there, TJ?
No, it's just, I think this is probably the best movie.
Yeah.
But
sorry to interrupt you. I flip-flop between this one and Goblet of Fire is my favorite. I think right now this might be my favorite, but they're both really great. There's just so much in here that adds a lot, not only to the world, but also to the plot as things going, you know, Voldemort finally being revealed to the public after them trying to suppress it for so long. It's like, oh, Harry wasn't lying. You've been trying to suppress this, but the truth does come out, not how anyone wanted it to, but it's better that it did that way. There's so much here. So we've talked about favorite scenes. How about your favorite characters in this?
Bellatrix.
Mm.
Great villain. Really unfortunate that she had to play second fiddle to Umbridge as far as villains go for this movie, because that's not fair, really.
Yeah.
But I love Bellatrix's character. She's just clearly insane and extremely effective at being threatening.
Yes. Because, you know, you kind of get built up over time of like, hey, these guys, these Death Eaters, they're like Dumbledore's most trusted people. And sure, we get told that, but it's another thing to be shown that. It's like, oh, this woman's off her rocker and Sirius Black is dead because of what she's done. That changes a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Excellent choice. I mean, I got to go. I'm probably going to answer this for every single book whenever they appear. It's still Fred and George. Like, there's a reason that scene is my favorite. It's because it's like the buildup of everything they've been doing, all the experimentation they've done on their practical joke items that they're using their magic to try and enhance, that builds up on them getting the loan from Harry to eventually get their own business, that this whole time they're practical jokesters and pranksters, but they're really harmless. And like, no, not really. That they could do a lot more damage if they wanted to. And instead, they just choose to leave a giant swamp in the middle of the school when they definitely could have done worse and encourage a rebellion after that. They're my guys. But if I didn't have to choose them, because that's my easy answer, it'd be Luna. I love Luna's character so much. Her being introduced to this book so late into the series, it's like, it feels like she's been here this whole time to me. And she just is this very, I think the way Rowling put it is that Luna works on faith, Hermione works on reason, and the contrast between the two of them is a lot of fun because they're kind of like the ultimate examples of going too far in two different directions. But the way they play off of each other, the way that Luna just says things, she just believes things. I love that about her, and it helps give Jenny some more character too, in that, hey, this is the friend she's willing to stick by. She could be way more popular if she wanted to, but she's friends with Luna.
Yeah. Always been a big Jenny fan.
Oh, yes. And she gets a lot of improvement in this book as well, like acting on her own, like even for all we know, creating that bat bogey hex that ends up messing up Malfoy later on. Like, yeah, giving her a lot of agency and having them and Neville join them on the attack on the ministry to try and retrieve the prophecy was a lot of fun, like because they don't want to bring them with them, Harry, Hermione and Ron. But it's better that they do. And because of that, they got a chance to shine. Mm-hmm. All right. So moving on from there, how about what is your favorite news creature spell or what have you that was introduced in this book?
Okay. So it's been a long time. So I can't remember everything that was introduced book by book.
That's fair.
But the spell that I always thought would be the most fun, which I'm pretty sure was introduced in Order of the Phoenix, Deluminate?
Deluminate.
Right?
Is that...
Well, it's like the Deluminator, the thing that just takes
the back. But actually as a spell this time around.
Yeah.
Now, I think that happens here. Like, obviously, Dumbledore uses that item in the first book, but we don't, like, know what it is until I think about here.
Yeah. Because Hagrid gets it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and that's a great scene, too, is him resisting the ministry trying to arrest him after Umbridge has had enough of him and he makes them look like punks.
Yeah.
And gets away.
Yeah. Oh man, I love Hagrid.
Yes. I think it was Judy who said when we did the first episode, it's like how you look at Hagrid and the Weasleys is kind of like a litmus test of how good of a person you are.
Yeah. Just like, you know, in the book. In the books, they're like, anyone who mistreats the Weasleys, those are bad people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Now, for me, one of the things I love that they introduce here, outside of, like, we learn more about the Death Eaters and we get the Occlumency lessons with Snape, I think it's this one and, and all that are the Thestrals. When they show up, because, you know, you get this whole, well, it's just magic that's bringing the carriages to Hogwarts, obviously. But no, this is a creature that exists, that you don't see unless you've experienced and can comprehend death. And it kind of a good retcon to explain, well, obviously, you know, Harry's parents died in front of him when he was a kid, but he wasn't able to process it yet. So when Cedric dies in Goblet of Fire, this is him coming to grips with that. And this is a physical manifestation of those things. And they're so creepy looking and yet cool. And the fact that they used them to get to the ministry later on, that's a ton of fun. I love their design. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to mention Raxperts, but that's the next book.
Ah, okay. Oh, I did remember something in the process of this. And that's something that's been brought up before, but I think this is the first time actually physically being there. And that's the St. Mungo's Hospital. For all the magical cases that we learn in this book for the first time, where Neville's parents are, what happened to them, which helps increase the threat of Bellatrix for her participation in that as well. It's like, you know, why is Neville the way he is? Well, he's under the command of his grandmother, who is, you know, holding out hope to both of them that maybe something could be done for these two people who served under Dumbledore and, you know, the Order of the Phoenix forever ago. But like, magic hasn't come to the point where they can get them past whatever curse she placed on them. And they're just magically mad as a result. Because, you know, you get that whole idea of, well, obviously, you know, we deal with a lot of real world ailments, mental stuff like that is here. But what happens when you add magic to that side of things? What could happen as a result of that? I really enjoyed that.
Yeah. Turning Neville into a much more sympathetic character before he does like the full 180 into, wow, Neville's awesome.
Yeah. Yes. Because, you know, he gets that first scene. That one scene in the first book where he does stand up to his friends because, you know, he's scared of what could happen and he's praised for it by Dumbledore at the end. So there's something nice there. And he's gotten some moments like him trying to help Harry during the Triwizard Tournament, you know, and stuff like that. But here's like, oh, this is why he is the way he is. This is what he's fighting against. This is what he doesn't want to have happen again. So that's why he joins them to fight against the Death Eaters in the Ministry. That's a very important.
Yeah. And I think, you know, Neville could have been the chosen one. I think his backstory is better.
Ooh. Hot take. And speaking. Yeah. Go ahead.
You know, I mean, if the chosen one's parents weren't dead, but terminally unwell, I mean, that's better.
Okay. Speaking of that, our bonus question for this listeners is going to concern something we find in this novel where there is a prophecy and we learn that there were two candidates for the potential person for who this prophecy was about. The first one, of course, is our boy Harry. The second is it could have been Neville. So we're going to cover for our bonus question what would happen if Neville became the protagonist instead. Not as like a whole what if episode we could probably do along the way, but like kind of a general idea.
Yeah.
And if you want that to be a what if episode, let us know. So also as well, like we get, you know, Nagini was introduced in the last book. But like his importance to Voldemort in this one, I enjoyed that as well for how he's used as an agent that Voldemort can just send out. Nobody's really looking for this giant snake that can just kind of magically appear and disappear at will. That ends up almost killing Arthur Weasley. And in fact, in her early drafts, it did kill Arthur Weasley until Rowling, thank God, decided, no, we can't have Harry lose another father figure.
Yeah. Can't lose that many Weasleys.
Yes. And yeah. And imagine all the terrible things that would have happened to the family if Arthur had died. It's like, yes, they're already poor enough on their own. Don't really think the wizarding life insurances are going to be that grandiose for them.
No.
Yeah. There's a lot here. Now we could talk about for what else was introduced in these books, but I think that's good enough for right now. So we've mentioned it before. Dolores Umbridge, a play off of the word umbrage, spelled differently. But she, in this book, becomes kind of even a worse big bad for a little bit than Voldemort to an extent, in some people's opinions. Like, obviously, you've got, you know, Wizarding Hitler out there rallying people against everything, but you've also got this huge, gigantic jerk who you can see in front of you and is doing all these terrible things that we know are wrong. And I think that adds to her character. So, TJ, how do you feel about how Umbridge is handled in this book? And do you think that Stephen King is right to call her the second greatest villain ever created? In his opinion, the first is Hannibal Lecter.
Man, I think King is maybe half right here. She might be the second and Hannibal might be the first, but that's a big card to sell.
Consider subscribing on YouTube where you can get some other stuff. You get exclusive series like our comic book catch up, manga mustard, drinks with Tejas, and a companion series we do each year to go with our annual theme. You also get access to Friday Night Frights and Wednesday Night Weeaboo and Spidey Swing Bys with Christian Ashley. You get access to other exclusive shorts like what I'm going to be doing soon are non-canon, where I'm going to be reviewing different IPs that are outside of canon from our favorite fandoms or the Bible and discussing whether or not it should be canon. You also can get a short of Will's Wednesday pull list. So if you're into comic books, Will goes through his favorites of each week's pull list for himself. You also get other bonuses over there. Most of our
surprise content we'll put straight to YouTube going live over there that you can check out. And a lot of our regular episodes are also posted on YouTube if you just want to see our smiling faces.
Yes.
But she is an amazing villain. I love flipping the whole concept of the, you know, the big bad evil guy on its head. And, you know, our biggest op is Pink Pantsuit Lady. And she's great at it. She's menacing. She's foreboding.
Oh, yes.
Like, she does a great job. But it speaks to how effective presence can be over aesthetic.
Mm. Yeah, I can't remember her actress's name off the top of my head. But, you know, in the book, it's awful, it's terrible, but like to actually visualize it, she does perfectly in that role. It's like, I would want to punch this woman in the throat the moment I had my first conversation with her. And if that's not acting chops, I don't know what else is. Like, hats off to her, whose name escapes me once again, but she did a tremendous job. But as far as like what she has to do in the book, in the movie, this is menace in a way that is very antithetical in some respects to some of the earlier villains we've had. You know, Snape has kind of played the role of anti-hero, anti-villain, so on and so forth a little bit. Like, you know, he's still on the side of the angels as far as we're aware in this book. And obviously those of us who read the book know he is. And then we get, you know, Quirrell, who's this seemingly frightful guy who's working with Voldemort for more power because he's afraid. We get the Horcrux of Voldemort that we will later learn what that actually is later on, using the Basilisk to become the heir of Slytherin. We've got in book three what we think Sirius Black is, but in actuality it's Peter Pettigrew, this hapless, helpless, fearful loser of a man who sold out his best friends because he was scared. And then in book four, we've got Voldemort actually coming back from the dead through very convoluted means that have allowed him a chance to one-up Harry. And he's still out there, but our physical threat, for the most part in this book, is her. And what is it? The him or tut-tut or whatever she says. I can read that or I can hear that and I'm triggered immensely. Like, and it's just one small phrase.
Yeah, this is someone I can imagine in real life and would not get along with very well.
Yeah, and that's a great way of putting it, because this is easily someone that maybe an image popped up in your head while you were listening about this. And there's that one person in your life and they kind of have characteristics similar to this. And you want more than anything, if you could just tell them off, or if you're really like me and you really just want to just hit them once and just put them down. And let everyone know how much you think that they're worthless. It's like, hey, I need to work on that aspect of myself. There's that person. And Umbridge is that person. We can see her get her comeuppance at this point in time. And that's what makes her effective to me, is that not only is she a threat, but that she is dealt with. Now, as the books do go on, we do see her allying with certain other people who gets her back to prominence, but she gets what's hers later on. But still right here, it's that, when I meet you, the first thing I want to do is get rid of you. And that buildup keeps coming. That buildup keeps coming. That buildup keeps coming. And when it pays off immensely well.
Yeah. It's so cathartic.
Yes. And as far as what King has to say, I kind of agree. Like, I haven't like set out and actually written down like a list of all my favorite villains of all time or the greatest villains of all time. But she's on that list and she's probably near the top. Because of what she represents, this whole, oh, well, we can't have the students learning this. Like, Dumbledore is on the wrong side. He's trying to take over the ministry. So we're going to teach students nothing, which effectively neuters them, which is not supposed to be what the government is supposed to do involving school. Like, then it brings up that whole debate as well. It's like, should the government be involved in what's being taught the students? Like, if you get enough lobbyists around, if you get enough legislators around, well, who's to say that they're right to say that we should be teaching this and shouldn't be teaching that?
Yeah. And I think it helps that she's just the realest villain. Mm. Like, one of the realest villains in fiction, because, like, Hannibal, scary dude. But most people haven't met someone who they're like, wow, this guy's incredibly smart. I hope he doesn't eat people.
Yeah, I completely agree.
She does a great job.
Oh, yes.
Imelda Staunton.
It's like, thank you. A fantastic job she did. So kind of a little, in some respects, similar to what we've been talking about. Like one of the underlying themes throughout the series, and it's kind of really heightened in this book. We kind of got a little bit with Rita Skeeter in the last one, but it's really hyping up and ramping up is the word I should be using at this point, is that the media and the government are portrayed as being kind of wishy-washy and slanderous, as opposed to the weirder and more esoteric Quibbler being one of the few magazines, newspapers out there willing to speak about the truth. Like, in your opinion, how is this whole scenario kind of portrayed in the book and movie?
I don't know. I was really young reading this. So a lot of these things kind of went over my head of like media versus media, you know, media versus the people, the truth. But now it's a lot easier to see like, okay, this is freedom of speech. Like we're, you know, the government is trying to suppress the freedom of speech and control the media. And Luna's dad's not letting it happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll eventually meet good old Xenophilius later on. But it's one of those things where you kind of, as you get older and you recognize, well, I should just read the paper. I should just read this website. And that'll tell me everything I need to know about the world. And you grow up and you realize, oh, well, just because I read an article from Fox News, just because I read an article from MSNBC or CNN or BBC or Al Jazeera or wherever, it doesn't necessarily mean it's the truth, because there are people working behind the scenes who want a certain truth to be let out into the world. And that's not to say that all news, all media is fake. Like, the truth is still out there, but it's coming from biases, whether more liberal biases or conservative biases or what have you. Like, it's hard to have such to have a perfect view of what is happening in the world, because there's always something more than likely hidden behind what someone is saying in the news. And that's part of growing up, is learning, well, I used to think this way, but this person's saying this. So who should I trust? Where should I go? Now, as far as that answer goes, like, I typically get my news from like three different sources. I do CNN, I do Fox News, I do Reddit, and I do the BBC. Out of those four, more than likely along the way, I'm going to get some semblance of the truth, but that's me. I'm sure someone else would have a better idea than that, someone who has more experience. But that's what this book kind of taught. It's like, just because someone is telling you something doesn't necessarily make it true.
Yeah.
And there's also this whole ordeal of the fear for why they're not printing the truth. Because if Dumbledore and Harry are right, that means they didn't win the Wizarding War. Voldemort was still out there this whole time. No one did anything to stop him, and he's back. To have that be reality is not a universe I want to live in. So people will deny the truth because it fits their ideas of, I don't want that to be true, therefore I'm not going to think about it.
Yeah, and it's hard to blame them from that point of view, but it's actually extremely easy. You made a mistake, you have to own up to it.
Yeah.
Also, how could you have known he was basically immortal? That's not your fault.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of those things, it's like, well, in hindsight, maybe we should have done something, but yeah, I agree. It's not really their fault that they didn't think, he's been searching for ways to put his soul into multiple different vessels, and that's what keeps him alive, like this lich, as it were. It's like, no, honestly, I wanted to be with them this whole time. We won. He's gone. He's dead. Ding dong. The witch is dead. The wicked witch. Voldemort's gone. But no, the truth is the exact opposite. But instead of pursuing that truth, they chose the simplicity of lying because it made people feel better. Mm-hmm. And it gave them a laughing stock too. Instead of worrying about what the ministry's practices are here, you know, with, you know, how they're treating house elves or something like that. Instead, we can just put Harry Potter out there as this glory hound scapegoat who's like, oh, well, he got lucky once as a kid, and now he thinks that brings him fame and fortune. So look at this idiot compared to us. We're doing our jobs.
Yeah. Yeah. Harry's not a great scapegoat because he's just too good at everything he does.
And I do kind of like how it portrays the Quibbler here with the introduction of Luna, reading it, believing everything her father prints because that's just who she is. But then realizing, okay, well, people aren't going to listen to what the Daily Prophet has to say. But maybe we can get someone else to listen to us if we use basically the National Enquirer for the Wizarding World.
Yeah. Yeah. TMZ.
And you want to know? Yeah. Oh, pretty much. And you want to know how it works? They start to censor it.
Yeah.
Umbridge passes legislation within the school that bans the Quibbler. So, of course, what does that mean? Well, if there's a rule saying I can't do it, oh, I want to see what it's about.
Yep. That's exactly the kind of thing that would have happened to me. It's like, oh, yeah. Well, I really couldn't have cared less about this thing before, but now that you're not allowed to, it's kind of tempting now.
It's a fundamental misunderstanding of human nature to think, well, if I just ban it, no one will ever think about it. It's that whole kind of very legalistic sense of like certain things the church has handled in the past. If we just say, don't do this, that means they'll listen. It's like, no, if you're not, hey, here's why you shouldn't be engaging in these sins. Here's why you shouldn't be doing these things, which helps a lot more than, hey, just don't do it. Well, of course, well, what's so cool about the thing that you're trying to ban? What if I dip my toe in it? What if I like that first initial thing. Let's keep doing it. It's a fundamental misunderstanding of human nature to ban those things without explaining why.
Yeah.
Or for her case, it is explaining why, but making yourself look like a fool in the process.
Yeah. And this is a particularly hard thing to deal with trying to get banned. It's slandering you actively. And everyone knows because everyone's reading it.
And it's so good. I love that section of the book as well, because it's using the foundation that they've set up against you against them. Mm. So moving on from there, unless there's anything else you had on your head. Okay. So a part of this story is realizing they're not going to get the education that they need for their defense against the dark arts because Umbridge is in charge. And her thing is all about like nonviolence and blah, blah, blah. Sure. That's something that should be taught, but not exclusively as the focus of the class. Harry and the others start Dumbledore's army, which is kind of their pseudo rebellion of sorts to study behind everyone's, you know, eyes, everyone's backs in the room of requirement, with everyone except Slytherin being represented, I'm fairly certain, in the DA. And he starts to see as a focus of this that he's gained an affinity for teaching and for leading others. And as part of that, he decides that as he's deciding his career later on, poor 15-year-olds having to decide what they want to be when they grow up. Yeah, very sorry for you guys. He decides that he would be best suited to become an Auror once he graduates, which for those who don't know, that's basically your magical policeman. Do you feel like this is a proper path for him, or do you disagree with his choice?
I mean, you said it. Teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Leading others.
That's
he
what
should have become a professor.
Yeah.
He should have been the defense against the dark arts professor for the next, I don't know, 80 years.
Especially so after we eventually learned that the curse is overturned with Voldemort's final death. So I get your point there.
That's, you know, Hogwarts kind of earned a good defense against the dark arts teacher after the 7 years we saw being completely inconsistent. There was the same teacher for the class for two of the 7 years because it was Dolores twice. No. After
it was a new one. Every Snape was sixth book. He became headmaster in the seventh, so he did not teach. So I think it was the Karrows, the Death That's Eaters. Right. Because the curse was no one would last more than a year.
Yeah.
So we'll find out later on. As far as this question, I saw a lot of, over the years, people lashing back against the idea of Harry becoming a magic cop. And I think it's because of their own hangups on that, you know, profession, which, don't get me wrong, there's plenty of scrutiny to be thrown around. I just think people go way overboard in their zealousness for this. Fine with him doing it. But I also agree with you that I think he is a natural teacher in this respect. So my ideal version of Harry for this would be have a couple of years on the force, getting jobs done that way, And then 20, 30 years down the road, he decides to retire from that and become a professor. Because I think he's got invaluable experience to offer to the new students that are coming in. So I completely and utterly disagree with anyone who thinks he should never have become one just because of their own personal hangups on that issue. But I also agree, yeah, he has a knack for teaching. It's something he needs to foster.
Yeah, it's just when we see Harry at his happiest, it's when he's enjoying being a part of the magical world. So I can't imagine a better career path for him than being a professor and introducing other people to that same world that he was once completely oblivious to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's where he should end up at after however long he should be, because Hogwarts is really his home. I mean, yeah. The only other real home he has is the Burrow. But I think he's better suited to coming back there one day to teach other kids, to make sure that they know what they're up against in the world. Now, moving on from there, as a major resolution of something that has been kind of building up for a little time in the books is Harry's first crush on Cho Chang. What is your opinion on how this was written slash, you know, viewed on screen and about the fallout that happened because of it?
I don't care about Cho Chang even a little bit.
You know, as I was writing this question, I kind of thought that would be the answer, but I wanted to hear you say it.
Yeah. I've always been a fan of Jenny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's totally fair. I think when I was a young lad reading these books as they were coming out, it's like, oh, yeah, Harry and Cho, this is so fun. And like me having like the emotional capabilities of a teaspoon, not really understanding, oh, she's in the midst of immense grief right now. She's not ready for this. She needs someone to help support her in this. And Harry would have been about as effective as me at that point in time if I had been through that same scenario. It's like, well, you should probably get over it. It's like, that's not a good thing to say. That's not a good way to handle this scenario. And as a result, they just kind of break up. And that happens when you're young. There are people that you have immense crushes on. It doesn't guarantee that they're the one you're going to end up with just because there's some romantic tension there. Just because you set things up a little better, just because you go out on dates, doesn't mean you're going to end up being together. And I think Rowling did really well with this, you know, portraying what kids do as they're growing up. It's like, oh, they have these crushes on these people. They finally get the courage to say something. And then maybe something happens. Maybe it blows up in your face. And this kind of blows up in their faces.
Yeah. You know, with her like defending Marietta after Marietta betrays Dumbledore's army. I mean, that's kind of like, did you really want him that bad?
Yeah.
But to me, this whole plot, it's like subplot, you know, two books, it's whatever. I didn't really care about Cho Chang. It's cool that Rowling put it in so that she's not just writing like a perfect fantasy world where everyone our main characters like, they end up with.
Yeah,
it's good for young people to see, but I want to see wizard fight.
Yeah, and I'm with you 100%. When we get Harry and Ginny later on, I love that a lot. I think they're great fits for another. But part of that, and one of the other reasons why they truly break up for good, is that Hermione, when they're all writing down their names to join the DA, has put a jinx on it that will scar that person permanently for life, as far as we're aware, as a snitch. So do you think that she was right to jinx that sign-up sheet?
Yes.
And why is that?
Snitches get stitches.
I've seen a lot of debate on this one. And I see the other side's point. It is a permanent physical affliction that is sucks. On your forehead. That sure, maybe you could put a headband or something around it, but then you're going to be known as that person who always wears a headband. Why is that? Oh, because she has a giant snitch on her head. Well, why'd that happen? Because she sold out her friends to Umbridge when she was headmaster of the school. I was like, oh, well, I don't know if I really want to associate with you if you've shown no signs of repentance along the way. Yeah. So I get that point, but at the same time, this is deathly serious. And I don't think she really fully understood what she was doing when she sold them out to an extent. That as in what was going to happen to everyone else as a result of this, including her friend, Joe.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still one of those things that, hey, our actions have unintended consequences sometime. And this is a pretty obvious one, as people are going to see on her head as time goes on. She's still a student at the school for the rest of the books. But I'm with Hermione on this one. It's a clever way for to know, like, okay, like, we're doing the super secret thing. We're not going to do a Fidelius charm or anything like that to have a secret keeper, because that puts a lot of pressure on someone. And there's the whole thing of that. Well, no one really knew that if they weren't going to do this, then that was going to show up on their face. But that's its own thing. I think this is a clever way of saying, we got sold out. How can we know for sure who it was? And she doesn't tell anybody because Hermione's just that good.
Yeah. I mean, I think it could have been reckless, but she knows what she's doing.
Mm-hmm. So I agree with her at the end of the day. I see the other side's point, but this is like super serious. I need to make sure we know who's causing us to end up in these scenarios. So that's a good permanent way of doing so. So how would you ever be able to trust that person again?
I'm not.
Yeah. And if you didn't know who it was, well, then how are we supposed to find out? The paranoia brings up that could easily destroy entire friend groups.
Yeah, I mean, it's not. Now there's no rumors. Everyone knows exactly who it was.
Yeah. So you mentioned your girl Bellatrix earlier as your favorite. And as they eventually end up in the Ministry of Magic to find the prophecy that only Harry or Voldemort can pick up, because they're the ones it's intended for. That's kind of the rules of the place. And that's what the Order of the Phoenix has been guarding this whole time, because they know the Death Eaters have tried multiple ways to try and get in there, but none have worked, because that's the only way it works is for one of them to pick it up. Leading Harry on the idea that Sirius has been captured and put in the ministry, they put him in this scenario. But the Order of the Phoenix is able to make their way there to stop the Death Eaters from killing the kids. And unfortunately, in the midst of that battle, a very epic, great battle, Sirius ends up dying in the fight because he passes through the veil, and that's a capital V veil, in one of the rooms in the Department of Mysteries, which is where they discover that they try and research things that they really don't get. Like, how does the brain work? What is love? Like, how do prophecies work? What is time? And we kind of get the veil, which seems to be like a portal between the afterlife and here. So, in your opinion, TJ, what do you think happened to Sirius when he passed through that veil? Was he dead before? Doing that kill him?
Well, so for people who have seen the movie and haven't read the book, in the movie, she does cast the killing curse.
Yes.
She casts Avada Kedavra. So that just kills him immediately. And then he falls through the veil.
Yes, that is a huge difference.
Massive difference. And this book has actually a lot of differences, because it is the longest Harry Potter book, or second longest? No, it is the longest. And like the second shortest Harry Potter movie. Cut out a lot. And it's still really good, which is crazy.
Yes.
But I think what it is the veil. In Harry Potter, we see ghosts, but none of the ghosts ever talk about what it's like to be dead, what the afterlife is like. They don't know because they're ghosts. So in Harry Potter, as far as we know, after you cross that, you know, dimension into the afterlife, you can't come back. Mm-hmm. And the veil is the door to the afterlife. If you accidentally slip in, that's it. You're done.
Yeah. I think you're close. I think you're right there. Like, as far as like fully understanding it, I don't, but I'm fairly certain when they're doing their research in the Department of Mysteries, every person who has ever existed and has had consciousness has wondered what happens to me after I die. And the wizarding world is no different. So being able to have these magical capabilities, they've researched it. They've created this portal gate, what have you. That every time they've gone through it appears to be one way, as in like you end up in there and you're dead. And I think that's what happened to Sirius. He might have been able to survive whatever curse Bellatrix sent at him, but because he went from this side, the physical plane, to whatever metaphysical side on the other side of the veil there is, he died. and he cannot leave a ghost behind because it's kind of one of those things like as you die, you choose to stay behind or you choose to move on. And like, you know, Nearly Headless Nick and the Bloody Baron and so many of these other ghosts we see in Hogwarts don't know what happens because they chose to stick around.
Yeah.
And I think he's just unreachable. Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, I just wanted to say, like, they built the Ministry of Magic around the Veil.
Oh, that's right.
Like, the Veil, yeah. This is, like, one of the more interesting parts of the Harry Potter world building. Because, like, yeah, wizards are real. Door to Hell. Right here. What is that? What do you mean?
How'd you just have a
door that kills people? Like, they did public executions there. They didn't have gallows. They just, through the Veil you go.
Like, how does that work? What's going on here?
Like, I really want to know if the Ministry's even actually researching the Veil in there. Or they just don't want other people to be able to do stuff with it.
I mean, who knows? Like, I can't think of a more maddening job in the world than something like that, where, oh yeah, it's, this thing is here. We don't understand how it works. And are you doing anything about it? No, not really.
Nah.
We're using and that satisfies people. You? that satisfies you? Doesn't satisfy me.
Yeah.
So, maddening. Yeah. But it's super important. As part of growing up with these books, especially, you know, you're a little younger than me, but I was growing up with these books as they were coming out. And I got to see these characters I love grow up, but also some of them die. And I think one of the things Rowling was trying to teach to this is like, hey, death is a part of life. And eventually in other books, we kind of get to more, a little more blatant with like, hey, death is nothing to be afraid of. It happens to all of us. There's nothing you can't escape from it. Not even the resurrection stone can actually bring people permanently back to life. It's death is here. So wrestle with it in your own way. Do you have anything else you want to add, TJ, before we head off to the wrap up?
I wish they had kept Ron's Quidditch arc in the movie.
Yes. Oh, we didn't even touch on that. Weasley is our king.
Yeah.
Like that poor kid who wants to, his older brothers are just better at him and pretty much everything. And he gets the chance to be on a team. People accuse him of nepotism because he's Harry's best friend. He starts believing it in himself, but he finally gets that confidence to, you know, win a game for them near the end, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah.
And Weasley is our king is turned around.
Yeah. That's great.
I may be blending this and Half-Blood Prince.
One of the two. I don't know. I'm pretty sure even then he's still not the best Quidditch player in the Weasley family. Like,
yeah, obviously not.
Bill.
Yeah. I mean, Ginny's way better than him. I think Bill is better than him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unfortunate. Big family.
It happens. So, what do you all think of this, guys? Did you really enjoy this book? Is there something else we should have covered? Let us know. As far as that, let us know how you rate this book as we rate it and review it right now. TJ, how do you feel about Order of the Phoenix out of 10?
Eight.
Not. Wow.
I was gonna say 8 point something, but it's not. Yeah.
Okay.
It's hard to downplay this. I love this book. The movie is also fantastic. It just should be longer.
Yeah. Yeah. A 9 from TJ is about a 10 for most everyone else. So that's high praise.
No, I give out 10.
And speaking of, I know you do, but I'm talking about you're rarer to give them out than other people. And speaking of 10s. Since this is also, I think Order of the Phoenix and Goblet of Fire, I both rate them a 10 out of 10 for different reasons. They explore a lot more of the world. We get the coming threat of Voldemort set up in this scenario. We could have talked about the duel between him and Dumbledore, but, you know, for the sake of time, we got to move on from other matters. Like, this book means a lot to me. I loved it when I first came out. I loved rereading it not too long ago. This is a 10 out of 10 for me. But what do you guys think? Are you curious about our bonus question where we talk about what would happen if Neville had been the protag instead of Harry? Then check us out on Captivate to go figure what's going on over there. Please get a chance to leave a 5-star review in your podcasting platform of choice. TJ, do you have any recommendations for the good people?
If you haven't, check out The Cursed Child. You know, J.K. Rowling didn't just stop writing. If you just want more of the world, pick up The Cursed Child. Everyone loves it. It's great.
You're on a roll these days. Oh, goodness gracious. After that Gundam episode we had, man. Okay. That's my anti-recommendation, is The Cursed Child.
Yeah, it's bad.
But as far as actually giving an answer, The Bad Batch Season 3 just came out. Three straight episodes of goodness. I'm looking forward to more. I know we're going to be covering on What's News later on, but like, man, I'm in it to win it for this. I want to see how this wraps up. I don't feel good for this group to make it out all the way. At best, maybe Omega or someone else.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what we thought, guys. Real quick, just a thank you to some patrons in no particular order. Thank you to Aaron Hardy, Daniel Sigmund, Trip Fuller, and James Barrett. We appreciate what you guys do, helping us keep the lights on. We enjoy doing the extra work that we do for you guys, and these bonus questions and extra material like Manga Mustard, Comic Book Ketchup that you get access to before anyone, the votes that you guys get to have for what we're covering for All Reading Matters. Thank you guys for everything you do. Thank you, listeners, for all that you do as well, continuing to share these episodes with other people, continuing to listen. At the end of the day, remember, we are all a chosen people, a geekdom of priests.
Hello, friends. Are you enjoying what you're hearing from Systematic Ecology today in your earbuds, or whether it's on YouTube, or whether you're in traffic, or whether you're at work? Well, there's another way that you can stay engaged with us at Systematic Ecology, and that's on our Instagram account. Yes, hop over to Instagram, follow. We'll follow back, we promise. We post lots of fun stuff over there, whether they're updates on new podcasts that are coming out or getting ready to come out, or whether they're memes, or we're sharing what other of our friends are up to out in the world. Sometimes we go live at events, whether we're at a Comic-Con or whether we are just hanging out with friends on the back porch grilling out. You can follow us there. We also have videos and reels, like what's in Will's pull box from his local comic book store. He shares what he's reading in the world of comics. And then Christian is going to do some reviews of Spider-Man comics called Spidey Swing Bys. That's going to be fun. And then there's non-canon stuff. Non-canon? What? Yeah, Joshua's going to be reviewing one intellectual property from outside of the canon of his favorite fandoms, or a piece of literature that's a part of the biblical extra-canonical material. Man, that sounds like fun. But yeah, Instagram is one of my favorite social media outlets, and I love to engage with friends and family over there. And so we hope that you can engage with us there. Hello, friends. If you like Systematic Ecology, then there's a host of other podcasts in our network that we think you will like just as much. And so we're a part of the Anazal Ministry Podcast Network, and we hope that you can hop over and subscribe with all the podcasts that are in our network. Like, for instance, The Homily, which is, hey, Pastor Will Rose's sermon here in Chapel Hill, North Carolina at Holy Trinity Lutheran Church. You have another podcast called The Whole Church Podcast, the OG, the originals, the beginner of it all. Yes, Joshua Noel and TJ working for unity among the church and having great conversations with the wide spectrum of those who are involved in Christian ministry and the church. You have My Seminary Life, by Brandon Knight, who's discussing what he's learning in seminary, what's he is learning his theological studies, and bringing to the surface those big things that we're wrestling with and thinking through theologically in the church and beyond. There's the Let Nothing Move You podcast from Christian Ashley, who is walking through the Bible in a very Bible study type fashion and walking through the biblical narrative. You have Dummy for Theology. I don't think Joshua is a dummy, but hey, he's going to lift up theological themes that he's thinking about and wrestling with. And maybe there's not a lot of answers, but there's definitely a lot of great questions out there that he's lifting up with some great theologians across the whole spectrum of Christianity. And then there's the Bible After Hours. Man, if you like to get risky, if you like to get controversial, there's this foul-mouthed preacher who goes through the Bible from a more progressive point of view, challenging the status quo of the modern church. Yeah, you don't want any kids around with that podcast. And then you have the Clydes, one of my favorite couples that I like to listen to. One of the hosts here on Systematic Ecology, Taylor and Elizabeth Clyde, go through weekly discussions and kind of a devotional, conversational method of what's going on in their lives, where they see God moving in their lives, and what God is up to in the world. So those are the podcasts, a part of the AMP network. Subscribe, follow. We hope you can be a part of all that great network with the wonderful podcasts at AMP.